acting presidential.
All of us will not only keep in our thoughts and our prayers the people of the Gulf Coast, but we will act. We will act together. We will provide the necessary relief, the necessary comfort.
While New Orleans takes another hurricane hit, the Republicans get another shot at responding to disaster. Even before the storm hits, lessons of Gustav getting over Katrina. A storm surges on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, September 1st. Happy Labor Day to you, John.
Good morning, Adora. Happy Labor Day to you.
And today we're covering many angles of the impending Hurricane Gustav. How ready is the Gulf Coast? We'll talk to the Army Corps of Engineers. We'll talk to forecasters at the National Weather Service. And we're talking to a New Orleanian who evacuated and one who didn't. Also, the storm's being felt all the way up north, as you mentioned, John, in St. Paul, Minnesota, where the Republican convention has been scaled back in a big way today. Those stories and more. But first, these headlines.
Hurricane Gustav will soon come ashore just west of New Orleans. That's actually bad news for the Big Easy because that means it gets the nastiest side of the Category 3 storm. Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal called on a cast of thousands to help out.
There are 1,800 additional troops from other states en route to Louisiana. We've requested another 16,000 additional Guards troops. We expect them to arrive in the next 24 to 48 hours to help us with response, with rescue, and with recovery.
It's stormy in St. Paul, Minnesota, even though the forecast is still mostly sunny. The political climate is what's changed over the weekend. The Republican convention opens today, but party officials slashed the schedule in the face of Hurricane Gustav. Only essential convention business will happen.
The European Union has a group of civilian monitors ready to go to Georgia to see if Russia is complying with the ceasefire deal. This as the EU holds an emergency summit in Brussels today about Russian relations. Today, Russia's foreign minister called for a ban on weapons shipments to Georgia while criticizing the West for supporting Georgia's leadership. Iraq's western Anbar province is now back in Iraqi hands. The U.S. military has turned over control to Iraq's government. Some of the war's worst insurgent violence took place there, but violence went down as Sunni tribesmen turned against insurgents with American help.
Massive flooding in the northern Indian state of Bihar has forced 1.2 million out of their homes. Medical relief officials are racing to help victims there as disease and dehydration loom. In politics, Barack Obama visits cities in Michigan. John McCain has stops planned in Toledo, Ohio, and Philadelphia. And as we mentioned, it's quiet there in St. Paul on the first day of the Republican National Convention. Oil prices neared $117 a barrel. That's a suggestion that the market isn't as concerned about Gustav as it might be. American stock markets, of course, are closed for Labor Day. But it's back to school for most people.
Back to school. Parents are sending their kids off to college, and some aren't so happy about it.
They're not relieved?
No, they're not relieved. They're a little stressed out. They're missing their children.
Well, if you have an empty nest and you know this syndrome, do you have any advice for other parents who are missing their college-bound kids? And to you young people who are going off to college, what advice do you have to say goodbye to your parents without bumming them out too much? Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
And I've been watching this storm since Cuba, getting weaker and more disoriented. But you wouldn't believe that listening to the Weather Channel and all the media that is pumping out all this information about we're all going to die.
Of course, that's one New Orleans resident with a distinct British accent suggesting that it's not so bad as the media is saying. But for the real story, we go to Jessica Shower Clark, who's a meteorologist for the National Hurricane Center. Jessica, thanks for joining us.
Sure.
What can we say about Gustav up to the minute at this hour?
Well, Well, right now we are starting to get a few more observations that are in situ there with the system. Right now, or since it was over water, it was hard to get good observations, but we already have a 67-mile-an-hour sustained wind at Grand Isle, Louisiana, with gusts to 86 miles an hour. The system right now, Gustav, is about 85 miles south of New Orleans and about 20 miles away from the coast at Port Fourchon, Louisiana. It's still a Category 3 hurricane.
And it's packing a wind punch, but really the larger concern is the amount of water it's going to dump and how long it will take to dump that water, right,
yes,
Jessica?
That's correct. I mean, the storm surge with the system is going to be significant. It's already up to 10 feet in places and expected to go up to 14 feet. That's the water with above tide level, the rising sea level. Rainfall with the system is expected to be about 6 to 12 inches with up to 20 inches in places.
You know, some people have been talking about this northeast corner of the, you know, spiral on the storm, and that's sort of the nastiest slap that this storm is going to give, and New Orleans seems to be right in that zone. Is that consistent with what you're seeing?
Yeah, that's true. The storm surge is expected to be strongest on the eastern side of the system, so the sea level heights are supposed to be higher on that side. Also, there's tornado warnings at the moment for portions of southern Alabama and far eastern or western Florida Panhandle, too. That's associated with Gustav.
Just comparing to Katrina, how much water fell in the sort of, you know, the early moments of Katrina versus how much water is expected to come down from Gustav? Are they comparable at this point?
Well, I think the bigger threat here is really the storm surge, and that's the rising sea level height, not necessarily the rainfall that's going to fall out of the system. And at this point, like I said, it's about 10 to 14 feet with this system. That's very significant, and I think that people in New Orleans would be wise to have gotten out of there at this point.
And some of those levees can really only take about a 10-foot surge, right?
I'm not sure about that. You'd have to ask the Army Corps
right.
engineers.
Well, we've been talking to the Army Corps all. I mean, there are 285 or so levees, so it's different for each one.
Right.
I don't want to hold you to that. It's a very complicated question. So, what's the chance of this stalling in place and really causing an even greater, potential for damage because of flooding?
Well, you're right. It is expected to slow down as it moves inland, and it's supposed to be down to a depression by Wednesday afternoon over eastern Texas. And that's when the rainfall, again, will still be a threat over that area in Louisiana and portions of Texas and maybe even into Oklahoma and Arkansas at that point.
Ray Nagin of the mayor of New Orleans called this the mother of all storms. I don't want you to necessarily comment on what he's saying, but the New Orleans resident that we played the clip from at the top of the segment seemed to suggest that he wasn't worried. It's not as bad as the media is saying. What do you think?
I think this is a very dangerous Category 3 hurricane. I mean, I think that it's a dangerous system. I think people would be wise to listen to their officials because they have this kind of information and they've been able to assess the situation, and they said it was time to get out.
Well, it certainly encouraged 2 million people to get out, so they got that going for them, that's for sure. Jessica Shower Clark, thanks for joining us.
Sure.
Jessica Shower Clark is a meteorologist for the National Hurricane Center, and she spoke to us from Miami, Florida. So, from one end of the Mississippi River to the other, there's ripples from Hurricane Gustav. It's also affecting the Twin Cities.
I want to thank all my fellow Republicans as we take off our Republican hats and put on our American hats. And we say, America, we're with you. America, we're going to care for these people in their time of need.
John McCain speaking on Sunday. As the levees are being tested in New Orleans, it appears that the Republicans are being tested by this storm and its unfortunate timing at the beginning of the Republican National Convention. Joining us now is Jeff Sadowski, who's a national spokesman for the Republican National Committee. He's joining us from St. Paul. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, the water isn't rising up there, but the political ripples seem to have affected the agenda on Monday morning. Do you think this is a test of the Republicans and at the moment of the convention?
Well, I think as you look at this, convention you'll see a convention that is of a very different tone from the one you saw last week in Denver, or what you might expect from a normal convention. But I think the key here is to make sure that our priority is first towards the people in the Gulf region. And like John McCain had said, you know, take our Republican hats off and make sure that we are answering a call to serve. And throughout the campaign, he has talked about service and putting your country first. And I think this is one of those moments.
Certainly the nonpartisan theme is something that John McCain has talked about again and again throughout his Senate career even. Is this a real opportunity for him?
I don't think we're going to look at it as an opportunity because so many people are under the gun in Louisiana and across the Gulf. But it is a time where he will highlight exactly what he's been talking about throughout the campaign, making sure that we're doing everything we can as an American people, uniting the Americans instead of divisive political rhetoric.
Now, there are some cynics who might say that the fact that the President Bush is not going to appear at the convention today, same with Vice President Cheney, that allows some in the Republican Party to breathe an enormous sigh of relief since distancing themselves from the administration is part of the strategy here. What's your response to that?
Well, I think there's always going to be someone looking for a political angle to something or aiming to score political points. But I think the two key things. One, John McCain has been throughout his life his own man and throughout his career his own man, making his own decisions based on what he feels is best, not something tied to a political ideology. The second thing, though, is I think the president wisely decided to be down in, I believe he's in Texas, and I think that's important. Mrs. Laura Bush is here and she'll be appearing with Cindy McCain today at the Louisiana delegation breakfast, sharing our hopes and our best wishes for those here and their families back in Louisiana.
And Alaska Governor Sarah Palin has arrived in St. Paul, I understand. Part of the mission of this convention is to introduce her to the delegates and to the American people. How's that going?
Well, I think you see the response, whether it's yesterday in outside St. Louis or in Ohio and Pennsylvania over the weekend, just the response has been fantastic. Whether it's millions of dollars raised over the internet in the last couple of days since her announcement, or just the crowds and the response that we're hearing, feedback from our grassroots campaign as they're getting out the vote and building out the operation that'll help us win in November, just the response has been fantastic. And I think you see a governor who has over, whether it's as part of the Oil and Gas Commission in Alaska, as mayor of a town, or as governor of Alaska, someone who has not just talked about change and reform, but has actually accomplished it and fixed a corrupt old boy network in Alaska and is making some real positive changes.
Now, you just got off a conference call with the campaign. Is this all Hurricane Gustav updates? I mean, it sounds like you've got as much of a news responsibility as we do this morning.
Well, we're going to stay very, very flexible throughout, making sure that we're monitoring the situation down in the Gulf, making sure that our tone and any actions are appropriate. We have set up here for our delegates in the affected region an information center where they can go and learn about anything that's happening down in the Gulf. We've also dramatically scaled back our programming for today. You'll see a very, very different feel and a different convention than you have seen in years past. There is some official business that we have to accomplish.
I mean, you actually have to get you have to get McCain nominated, right? I mean, you have to actually
exactly.
Those are
to make sure that he is on the ballot. Exactly.
Right. I mean, if you don't do that, he's not on the ballot, right?
Exactly. So there's certain things that we're legally bound to do, but we'll be flexible and you'll hear more updates as the days come. I think the key is we're keeping an eye on down there right now and hoping for the best,
right.
And we'll make changes as necessary.
All right, Jeff Sadowski, thanks for joining us, national spokesman for the Republican National Committee, speaking from St. Paul. They have their work cut out for them there.
They do.
In St. Paul,
it's all
sure.
So unusual, unprecedented. Nobody knows exactly how this is all going to turn out, and they can't. They have to monitor it, just like you said, like everyone else is, hour by hour.
It's interesting how McCain tries to project this comfort, but he's not the president. It's a kind of a strange irony.
Yeah, but they've both been doing it a little bit, McCain and Obama.
All right, Gustav, more on a moment.
Yeah. You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning on this Labor Day as Hurricane Gustav makes its way to land. There are many hoping that officials at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers are right when they say much of the levee system in and around New Orleans is sounder today than it was before Hurricane Katrina. But there are some who are skeptical, given that the levee failures led to massive flooding after the 2005 storm. Colonel Alvin Lee is a commander of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. He's in New Orleans today, and he joins us. Good morning and welcome, Colonel.
Good morning, and thanks for having me on your show.
It looks like Gustav is heading just west of the city. Can you describe the network of levees that's likely in its path?
Yes, we have in the greater New Orleans area, we have approximately 275 miles of levees that make up the greater New Orleans hurricane storm damage risk reduction system. Outside of New Orleans, and this is to the west and south, there's another hurricane project called La Rose to Golden Meadows. And so those are the two primary hurricane protection projects in southeast Louisiana that are completed. And so those are the two projects.
And what state are they in? How prepared do you think you are?
Well, in New Orleans, New Orleans is the first city in the nation to have a comprehensive system. And so we're building that right now. Of course, we're not completed with that system, but New Orleans has the best protection that it's had in its history. And I say that pretty confidently because we have done a lot of work since Hurricane Katrina. We have reinforced flood walls at numerous locations. All of the eye walls that were breached during Hurricane Katrina have been replaced with stronger T-walls at the breach sites. Our flood walls have also been armored, and that's so if there is any water that goes over the flood walls that you won't get scouring on the protected side. And then the transition points between flood walls and levees also have been armored with rock to keep the erosion of water from eating away at the soil materials.
Well, let's talk about erosion for a moment, Colonel. We were just told by the National Weather Service that this could be a flood event lasting days. So you could be looking at breaches that aren't episodic but actually are sustained, in which case the erosion would be pretty significant, kind of no matter what you have there as reinforcement.
Well, one of the things that we did after Katrina is we made some assessments on the materials that we used to build levees, and we used to use a lot more sand and organic materials to build the levees. Now we have changed to a higher clay, and so we have very few organics and sand matter in the levees, and then we also use grasses and other armoring to make sure that the levees don't erode when we have a heavy rainfall. Falls and overtopping. So those are some of the lessons learned we use from Katrina to make the system more resilient. And one of the key things in New Orleans is really New Orleans is kind of like a bathtub. Many parts of the city are below sea level, and what you're talking about with heavy rainfall, it is a concern because the city's capability to pump the water out of the city is about 1 foot for the first hour, one inch of rain for the first hour, and then a half of an inch every hour thereafter. So if they get, you know, 15 inches of rain in a pretty short period, the city will likely see interior flooding throughout the low parts of the city, and then it'll take time to pump that out of the city.
Hmm. Now, Governor Jindal yesterday expressed some concern that the Army Corps hadn't done all the work it was supposed to, particularly west of the city. And how do you respond to that?
Well, on the West Bank, the thing that needs to be noted about the West Bank is that when Hurricane Katrina hit in 2005, the West Bank and vicinity only had 30% of its projects completed. So, on the other portions of the system, about 85% of the projects were completed. So we are what we call accelerate to complete, and we're working as fast as we can on the West Bank. Of course, as you heard me say, this is not a small system. There's over 275 miles of levees, and those levees are not something you can just go out and build, you know, in a few months. Mm-hmm. They take multiple lifts, and they're pretty. It's an extensive construction requirement to get them to the level. We're scheduled to be completed with our system in 2011. So that's when we see the 100-year level of protection that would be provided there.
As for today, what kind of preparations have you made, and what kind of teams do you have in place?
Well, we're part of the federal government's Unified National Response to Disasters and Emergencies, and we work very closely with the Department of Homeland Security and FEMA, and we have responsibility for organizing public works and engineer-related support, and that includes any type of response to debris removal, commodities procurement, temporary emergency power, temporary housing, temporary roofing, infrastructure assessment, and also support to urban search and rescue.
So how many people do you have down there who are watching these levees, who are pulling together the resources you may need if problems arise?
Well, we have approximately 260 personnel deployed here in New Orleans, and this is forward deployed, and then we have additional personnel in Baton Rouge and also in Vicksburg, Mississippi. So we have done a number of measures to make sure we're prepared for this hurricane. That includes exercising the gates. We have surge gates. One of the surge gates on the Harvey Canal on the West Bank, that the area you were referring to earlier,
right.
We have closed that surge gate so that we can reduce the risk for the West Bank, and that's one of the measures that we keep doing as a Corps of Engineers is to make risk-informed decisions and help reduce the risk to the city.
Thank you, Colonel. Colonel Alvin Lee, commander of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. He is in the New Orleans District. He is the New Orleans District 60th Commander and District Engineer. And now we go to Femi, who's got some headlines for us. Femi?
Hello there, Dora. Good morning, all. Just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. Hurricane Gustave is approaching the Louisiana coast. The center isn't on land yet, but the coast is getting plenty of wind and rain. The National Hurricane Center issue an advisory every few hours during a hurricane, and they say, and I quote, preparations to protect life and property should have been completed. It looks like New Orleans is well on track. Most of the city is empty as many locals heeded the evacuation orders. Beefed up police and National Guard forces will patrol the streets to stop looting. And Mayor Ray Nagin promises looters will go straight to the state prison. Adora, I was watching Mayor Nagin doing his press conference yesterday, and he said that if you caught looting, you'll go straight to Angola. I was like, wow, that is harsh. That's a long way to go. Then I realized that Angola was
talking about the penitentiary in Angola,
like,
the dreaded penitentiary in Angola.
Me. I have been to Angola, so I wouldn't really wish that on people unless they're prepared. But the food is great there. Meanwhile, the Republic National Convention starts today in Minnesota, but Republicans have drastically scaled back events there as Hurricane Gustave menaces. Only mandatory party convention business will happen today. That's a quick look at your main news headlines all about the hurricane.
Many thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, which asks, is there an age when people should no longer be held accountable for their actions? Can someone be too old to be responsible? Or is that ageism? Opinions shared at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Hurricane Gustav asks the question, do I stay or do I go? It's an existential question for anyone living on the Gulf Coast as Hurricane Gustav, a Category 3 hurricane, approaches and hits the land. And we have on the line with us someone who made the decision to stay, as well as someone who made the decision to leave. staying in New Orleans is Lolis Eric Eli, Metro columnist for the Times-Picayune. Lolis, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, John.
And someone who decided to leave is Michael Rushing, who's the manager of the Cigar Factory stores in New Orleans French Quarter. Michael, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And Michael, where are you right now?
Right now, I'm actually in Houston, Texas.
I see. So you're quite a ways away.
Yes.
All right. So, well, I'll talk quickly from you, Michael. Why did you decide to leave? And then I'm going to ask Lolis why he decided to stay. Michael, you first.
I felt, along with the ownership at the Cigar Factory in New Orleans, we felt to ourselves that we can actually put the business in the right situation to where if something on the level of Katrina actually came at New Orleans, we need to be able to really just make the best business decision of trying to get our more important product out of the store and actually just take it out of harm's way. And so that's what we did. I mean, as much as we want to make sure we stay near to New Orleans, but we just felt as far as after Katrina that we needed to actually do that.
Lolis, so why did you stay? I know you're a columnist, so on some level the answer is sort of obvious.
Well, the other thing is that the decision was easy initially because my sister works for the Department of Health and Human Services. They were told at first that they had to stay. Then they relaxed it to say that she had to work an overnight shift ending at 6 a.m. yesterday. So the whole time that I thought I needed to be here with her, I was making provisions for how to see to it that we'd be as safe as possible and consider leaving. But then a couple of things dawned on me. One is that during Hurricane Katrina, the water level in the city was equivalent to the water level in Lake Pontchartrain, meaning those areas that did not flood then were unlikely to flood now. And I live on high ground near the French Quarter. And the combination of the fact that I wanted to be with my sister and that it didn't appear as though things would be any worse in my part of the city, and the fact that the story is here, those three things combined to keep me here.
Well, I address a question when we have two guests to one person, but this question is deliberately to both of you, and I want you to answer right away. Is there a kind of New Orleans macho about if you stayed or if you went during a storm in the aftermath of a storm?
Not anymore, I don't think. I think Katrina killed that. But the other thing is that the conversation about leaving is relatively recently as storms have increased in intensity and frequency. When I was a kid, that might have been, there's a famous story about some folks on the Gulf Coast of Mississippi who had a hurricane party. Everybody was so drunk that when they got drowned, nobody knew what was going on. I don't think that anyone has that kind of callous attitude anymore.
Michael, are you concerned that, in the aftermath of Katrina, there was an enormous amount of damage that accrued to businesses from, looters and other kinds of situations just related to the neglect of retail establishments? Are you worried about any of that in this case?
As far as our business, no. We actually are a cigar factory, and we manufacture all of our own cigars, the only one of its kind within the state of Louisiana. But we just really don't have things such as, TVs and those typical things that looters actually go for. So for us, we never thought of being susceptible to it. But for us, it was no problem for us to take off because right after the hurricane, I felt we came back fairly soon, within a month of when it actually last occurred. So it's to us, we didn't, Houston to us is not very far to actually just making that commute back.
Last question to both of you. And it sort of occurred to me as Lolis was talking there a moment ago. Really, this, you've all been through hurricanes before, right?
Yeah.
So, there's a kind of a ritual about when the storm comes, here's what we're going to do, here's what they say, here's we stay, we go. Katrina has totally changed that. As this storm arrives, it seems like everyone has behaved very differently than they ever did in the past. Michael?
They have, and I think just because of the intensity of the storms that are supposedly coming, toward New Orleans. And some people just really can't take that chance. And as far as, you know, with when things go over level three, you guys can expect levees to give away possibly. And some people just cannot make that choice, especially if you're in those low-lying areas.
Right.
So that's why I think where everything gets thrown out the window as far as the everyone staying here in New Orleans, you know, becomes.
It's a different world. Lolas, you get the last word.
Well, things have gotten a lot more intense these days because our coast has eroded. People, even if they don't know the science, know that they need to be more concerned than they used to be.
Lolas Eric Eli is a Metro columnist for the New Orleans Times-Picayune, and Michael Rushing manages the Cigar Factory store in New Orleans French Quarter. Thanks to you both, and good luck.
Darling, you got to let me know. Should I stay or should I go?
The Clash with the question, with the answers. Femi Oke.
Definitely, I've got to stay. I have to do some news headlines for you. Good morning. It is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Hurricane Gustav is still over water, but it's been raining in New Orleans since last night. The Category 3 storm will come ashore just west of New Orleans. Most in the city have evacuated, and those staying behind are under strict curfew as police patrol the streets to prevent looting. The reach of Hurricane Gustav stretches all the way to Minnesota. Republicans are shifting their convention plans in St. Paul because of the storm. The party scaled back events today to include only the legally required business of moving John McCain's nomination forward. President Bush and Vice President Cheney both cancelled their convention trips. Just getting news in on the Associated Press wires about the Japanese Prime Minister announcing his resignation. He has become increasingly unpopular because of his efforts to lift the ban to re-import American beef back into Japan.
That's pretty huge.
Yeah, I will bring you more news about that. I'm assuming those two things are related, but I will get the facts and not assume anymore. Meanwhile, as we head across towards China, the official news agency there says that a weekend earthquake in Sichuan killed dozens and injured hundreds more. The disaster destroyed more than a quarter of a million homes, And in Iraq, Iraqi forces are now in control of the once volatile Anbar province in the west. The handover from the US military symbolizes growing security gains there. So it actually is a morning of some really major news stories, including the European Union meeting to discuss what to do about Russia. And the European Union, ahead of their meeting, says that we are a very powerful body and Russia needs to work with us rather than against us.
Yes, Femi, I was actually looking on the wires. Nothing new. Japanese Prime Minister just has announced resignation. We'll find out more later. Yeah. Thanks, Femi.
All right.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and I'm about to tell you about something, John, that I know you don't know about because you just told me that you don't know about it. And we're talking about Eagle, Idaho, where they haven't been sleeping too much, or at least they didn't get too much sleep last night. Isn't that right, T?
Oh, yeah. We're out here doing the Eagle Rib Cook-Off and Spud Fest out in Eagle, Idaho. And temperature outside right now is 50 degrees, and we've been up all night cooking our large meat.
Cooking your large meat. There are 21 teams who are going for the trophy there, and they've been watching over their smokers full of brisket, ribs, and pork, which has been cooking slow and low. That sounds so good. And or really, T, should I be calling you the Sultan of Sauce?
Oh, yeah, that's a nickname in the barbecue world for me, the Sultan of Sauce. That's mainly because I mix a lot of sauces. And they're really good, so I picked up that nickname, the Sultan of Sauce.
And they're really good. Not to toot your own horn there, huh?
Pardon me?
I said not to toot your own horn there.
Oh, yeah.
T, I mean, Doris said I didn't know about Idaho barbecue. That's true. But I do a bit of brisket on my own, and I just want to know, are you a dry rub man or are you a wet rub man?
Oh, yeah, I'm a dry rub man. You know, I do a dry rub on both brisket and my pork shoulders and pork butt.
So what are you cooking up tonight, or I should say this morning for today?
Okay, well, our large meats, you know, we cook them anywhere from 12 to 18 hours, some of the guys, and that's according to what temperature you cook at. Some guys cook around 200, 220, 225, and, you know, it takes a while for it to reach its completion as far as temperature, the internal temperature. But we put our large meats on at night, which is the brisket and the pork, and then in the morning, in a few hours, we'll start our ribs and our chicken. So, and then we have a turn-in at 12 o'clock.
So what kind of sauces have you put together?
The sauces I use?
Uh-huh.
I use two different sauces. They're sweet. The trend out here is kind of sweet. I cooked against a gentleman last week, and he was from Virginia, Checkered Pigs, and he's now in Reno cooking, and he's real sweet. You know, we called him lollipop pork. Yeah.
Well,
so it's interesting, you know.
I think some people suspect that one of your key ingredients may be raspberry Kool-Aid.
No. one of the guys that tasted some of my rub, just because it had a red tint to it, he thought it was a raspberry Kool-Aid, but that's not what I used. It's another flavoring.
So you're down on the whole Kansas City vinegar approach, right?
No, I'm not. You know, every region around the country has a different taste to it, but I'm not down. I'm down. Does mean putting it down or what?
Well, no, they're not sweet in Kansas City. They're more sour and hot. But same with North Carolina.
Paprika and stuff, but you know, when you go cook in these regional areas, that's, you have to be able to adapt to that taste. Otherwise, I mean, I'd be foolish to be cooking in a sweet zone and then come with some mustard based sauce, you know what I mean, because the judges wouldn't go for it. So
you gotta get your strategy together,
right?
Last question for you. It's really a lot of there's a lot of camaraderie here. I mean, this is about respect in the barbecue world.
I mean, I've cooked against I'd say half of these teams throughout the year, and next week we'll conclude my 11th cook, and I'll be finished for the year. But yeah, we're all buddies, and we root for each other and cheer for each other. And when the season's over, you can't wait to see them next season. It's just like another family, and you know, the camaraderie between everybody is great.
T, we wish you all the best of luck today.
Okay,
T is the owner of Q for You Barbecue Restaurant in South Kearns, Utah.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. We have headlines for you. Femi Okeh has just joined us. Femi?
Thank you very much. It is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. FEMA's second-in-command says that Hurricane Gustav is expected to be a catastrophic storm when it slams into the Gulf Coast late this morning. But there's enough food, water, ice and other supplies stockpiled for 1 million victims over the next 3 days. FEMA Deputy Director Harvey Johnson says the eye of the storm is expected to pass west of New Orleans, but its surge will likely overtop levees and at least partially flood the city that was hit hard by Hurricane Katrina in 2005. And the pictures I've seen from New Orleans recently have just shown actually the pavements are wet, the wind is picking up, nothing dramatic quite yet. President Bush says the turnover of control over Iraq's Anbar province from U.S. troops to Iraqi forces today is a major achievement. He says the once violent region had been, and I quote, transformed and reclaimed by the Iraqi people. Anbar was the center of the Sunni insurgency after Saddam Hussein fell in 2003. It was troubled by violence and instability, but improved after Sunni leaders gradually turned against al-Qaeda. A powerful bomb packed with steel nails exploded on a passenger bus at a public terminal in the southern Philippines today. It killed at least 6 people and wounded 26 others. Police say the attack may have been part of an extortion ring that's been targeting the bus company. European leaders are meeting in Brussels this morning to discuss the crisis in relations with Russia following the recent war in Georgia. Current holder of the EU presidency is France, and Eric Chevalier from the French Foreign Ministry is keen to emphasize that the European Union is a force to be reckoned with.
In terms of demography, we are 3.5 bigger than Russia. In terms of economics, we are 15 times, and they know that. I mean, there is a time where I think Russian authorities will understand that on the midterm, long term, they have full interest in having good relationship with Europe, as we have interest in having a good relationship with Russia.
Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, in response to the meeting, warned that if the U.S. and her allies continue to support President Saakashvili, it would be a mistake, and I quote, of historic proportions. Let's look at some of the main stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi. So a lot of things are being tested in New Orleans today, as Femi Okeh points out. It's not only the levees. The Republican Party is being tested at the other end of the Mississippi River. Its convention begins today in St. Paul, but it's a very scaled-back affair. For one, the president is not going to be there. He'll be down monitoring emergency preparedness in Texas. Protesters who had come to St. Paul with the idea of delivering messages to the Bush administration and also to the rest of the nation, they're also being tested. Can their protests and their messages rise above the Gustav news? That's a question for Ben Calhoun from Chicago Public Radio, who was part of our Takeaway convention coverage team last week in Denver. He's now in St. Paul. And also WNYC radio reporter Bob Henley, who is also in St. Paul for the convention this week. Bob, let's begin with you. When did the protests start, and what indication is there that the authorities are going to respond in some way?
Well, actually, it started on Saturday. We got a call, an email from a police accountability activist and New York videographer, Eileen Clancy, with Eyewitness Video. She said that she was under a form of house arrest and surrounded by heavily armed police. I got there, and there was kind of like a media standoff in front of a purple New Age house, two-family, lush garden in the front. And there was, I guess, clearly a lot of police, maybe 40 or 50 media people, and it was kind of a standoff while they searched the place. There was an automatic rifle on one soldier, there's a Freudian slip, on one police officer's hip. And we were hanging around, and then all of a sudden, a neighbor to this house, Kimmy Love, African-American middle-aged woman, came out and said, "They're in the back. Come on the back. You can take a look at my neighbors. This is a free country. This isn't right." And we ran up the hill, and we were able to encounter the folks that had been arrested. And after a while, the police released them, but they had searched the home. And we had a chance to speak with the gentle giant 60-year-old Mike Whalen, who owned the home, who had opened his home to the protest supporters and the police accountability activists. And this is what he told us was on the search warrant that was presented to him.
Photos, writings, images which show association with or involvement in terrorism, direct violent action, threats to law enforcement and or government officials. Mail or other evidence which tends to identify individuals living or staying at this property, cell phones, computers, pagers, and other communication devices.
So this was a search warrant that the authorities delivered to this individual who owned this house because the authorities were trying to intimidate? What do you think was going on? I mean, the authorities...
It's hard to say. Well, because the information affidavit, which explained the rationale, was not offered and won't be available until after the RNC because of the way that the local criminal law process works here. But this was part of a number of sweeps that happened throughout the city. The elected sheriff from Ramsey County, Bob Fletcher, did have a high-profile press conference where he showed what he said were elements of an anarchist criminal conspiracy that he had been able to discover through, confidential informants, and it included things that might disable buses, makings of Molotov cocktails. But in this case, Eileen Clancy...
This is what they were looking for, or this is what they found?
Right, this is what they found in some of the raids, because there were several. And not in this house, but in several others. What did finally happen is we got an account for Eileen Clancy firsthand, who was inside, who was very much involved in police accountability going back to the RNC in 2004, and this is what she had to say to describe what happened.
They broke through an adjoining door that was locked and came down the stairs with a handgun and drew down on us. We were told to put our hands on our head. We complied. We were told to put our cameras down. We complied. We were videotaping this whole thing, of course. And then we were cuffed and taken to the back garden.
Bob, quickly, do the authorities have any explanation of this? Do they have a response or a statement?
No, other than the press conference that had happened where they showed some of what they had. Again, we're going to have to wait. They were silent when we encountered the officers. There was no public information officer present at the time, and they would not provide us any explanation.
Ben Calhoun, what's the mood among the protesters now that at least there's some indication that the authorities are going to crack down pretty hard?
Well, you know, people are exactly the kind of nervous that you'd expect with some half a dozen raids. Yesterday I got a call that there was another group that was being raided from a reliable person in the organizing community, and I, you know, scooted around the security zone as fast as I could, got over there kind of sweaty, only to find that nothing had actually happened. It was just a the group said that no raid was being conducted and everything was fine. But that's sort of the aura that's being created by this. In terms of strategy, I think that people are thinking that this could cut both ways. There's a city council member, Dave Thune, from the 2nd Ward, whose ward includes downtown, and he sort of said that to me. This is how he said it.
We don't club demonstrators, and we don't roust 20-year-old kids because they don't dress in a suit.
What do you think is the atmosphere that's been created now because of that?
Well, it gets everybody jittery. But I'm not sure it's doing anything to curtail people's enthusiasm for demonstrating or to speaking out against the stuff, because it, I think it's backfiring in the sheriff's office that whether they find some criminals or not, they still took measures that were extreme to get where they got. And in a way, maybe it's good for free speech that this happened.
Ben, before we go, what is the protesters' mission at this point, so far as you've been able to discern?
Well, it's diverse. As the organizing community is, they've got a lot of different groups that are involved here. But I think the biggest question is that you've got a lot of diverging opinions on how the protesters adapt their plan to respond to the changes in the convention itself. It's sort of like everybody had their choreography plan, but the music didn't start when expected. So everybody's a beat off, and they're sort of trying to figure out how they get going again.
So from the White House to the protesters, everybody is changing their choreography in the wake of Hurricane Gustav. Ben Calhoun from Chicago Public Radio and WNYC's Bob Hanley, part of our Takeaway Convention coverage. They're going to be all with us all week from St. Paul.
And today is Labor Day, and we hope you've got the day off. We certainly do. But we here at the Takeaway, well, we're working. And we've also been thinking about Labor Day songs. So we made a Labor Day playlist. Anything from 9 to 5, Dolly Parton,
sure,
to Working Class Hero.
John Lennon.
What do you think is the best song for Labor Day? Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Just enough for the city.
Stevie Wonder. Jax emailed that suggestion to us, saying, "My favorite Labor song is Stevie Wonder's 'Living for the City.' You should have played that at the convention," according to Jax.
Exactly. And as John noted, we're also following the path of Hurricane Gustav. It's currently a Category 3 hurricane, but there's no expected change in strength before it does hit land.
In the latest forecast, the eye is nearing the Louisiana coast. The center is 85 miles south of New Orleans, a matter of hours before it hits the coast.
And on this Labor Day, here's your takeaway.
Oh, yeah, I'm a dry rub fan. I do a dry rub on both brisket and my pork shoulders and pork butt.
And pork butt. That was T of Q4U Barbecue Restaurant in South Kearns, Utah, telling us how to make a good barbecue, which is what he's doing in Idaho at a competition.
Right. He's a dry rub man. They're the best kind, the best kind. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
He's not going anywhere.
If anything really bad comes, maybe we'll leave, but I mean, I'm pretty much going to stay. My house is like, this building was like from 1827 or something like that. This building's not going anywhere.
Anything really bad? If it's good enough for his building, it's good enough for him. New Orleans resident Damian Estevez is riding out Gustav. But 2 million residents of the Gulf Coast have another idea. Mandatory evacuations, temporary levees. When waiting is no game, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Monday, September 1st. Labor Day. Happy Labor Day, John.
Happy Labor Day, Adora.
Today, we are taking a very close look at Hurricane Gustav, which is making its way to Louisiana's coast. 2 million people along the Gulf Coast have already evacuated, and the storm has forced Republicans in St. Paul for their convention to change gears. The convention now, or at least today, will largely be procedural and not ceremonial. And parents who are dealing with the bittersweet experience of sending their children to college. We have that story and more, but first, some headlines.
Hurricane Gustav isn't quite on land yet, but the Louisiana coast is already getting a beating of wind and rain, including New Orleans. Louisiana didn't want a repeat of Katrina, with people stranded after the storm, so state leaders urged people to get out. Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal says most did.
Local estimates are that as many as 95% have evacuated. That would put the total at a little over 1.9 million people. There was a question asked earlier today. That would indeed be the largest evacuation in Louisiana's history.
The governor also got extra National Guard troops to protect against looting after the storm. John McCain is the presumptive Republican presidential nominee. He needs the party convention to get that presumptive label off. Those festivities start today in Minnesota, but very much without the festive part. Republicans have drastically scaled back events at their convention in the face of Hurricane Gustav.
Russia is accusing the U.S. of smuggling weapons to Georgia inside humanitarian aid ships. The foreign ministry made that charge today, and Russia has called for an arms embargo. This is the latest in a line of anti-U.S. criticism. Prime Minister Vladimir Putin said last week that the U.S. started the conflict in Georgia, which the U.S. strongly denied. Iraq's western Anbar province is now back in Iraqi hands. The U.S. military has turned over control to Iraq's government. Some of the war's worst insurgent violence took place there, but the violence there has dropped significantly as Sunni tribesmen turned against the insurgents with American help.
Massive flooding in the northern Indian state of Bihar has forced 1.2 million out of their homes. Medical relief officials are racing to help victims as disease and dehydration loom. The Associated Press is reporting, we should note, that the Prime Minister of Japan has resigned. No further details. We'll have more on that later in the hour. In politics, Barack Obama swings through Michigan. John McCain visits Toledo, Ohio, and Philadelphia. Oil prices are actually edging down. Gustav is not an issue, according to the oil markets. The stock markets in America are closed for Labor Day. But it's back to school.
It is back to school. Lots of parents sending their kids, dropping them off, leaving them at colleges this year.
And weeping as they go back to their cars to drive home to their empty nests. Any advice from parents to other parents about how to ameliorate, mediate that empty nest feeling? And also, kids, how do you say goodbye to your parents without bumming them out? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
And I've been watching this storm since Cuba, getting weaker and more disoriented. But you wouldn't believe that listening to the Weather Channel and all the media that is pumping out all this information about we're all going to die.
That's Alan Pond, who's decided he's not evacuating along with the roughly 2 million people who have fled from the Gulf Coast as Hurricane Gustav has approached. It's already begun lashing Louisiana and a storm at a Category 3 status. We begin in New Orleans with George Estevez. George, good morning.
Good morning, you guys. How you doing?
So how are things in New Orleans right now?
Things at this point, the storm is picking up. It is daylight. Power's out in parts of the French Quarter, but not in downtown New Orleans. And I just came out from a two-hour drive after I spoke with you guys earlier today. I hit the streets in New Orleans to see a lot of wind and a lot of rain and the Mississippi River. A lot of white caps on there, which separates the west from the east bank here in town. So the winds are picking up, and then at times they don't pick up and die down. Then it just feels like a bad rainstorm. But again, those gusts do come, and they come pretty strong at this point.
And when you were driving around, did you see any people, any activity at all?
No,
activity whatsoever. A lot of cops, let me tell you. A lot of police officers are driving the streets in New Orleans. You know, we all remember the situation 3 years ago when Hurricane Katrina hit the New Orleans area. A lot of looting, a lot of crime, a lot of people. Well, you need people to commit crimes, and right now 90% of the city is gone. So there are no people, so they expect a lot less crimes at this point. As far as people are concerned, there are people that are staying. These are old homes, you know, those balconies, those two-story areas here in New Orleans, with the planters hanging out, very old, 1800s, 1900s, and they're staying in these homes. They're made of brick, they're made of concrete, not like some of the prefab homes today. So there's some very few people are riding out in the French Quarter. That's a higher elevated place. It's like 8 feet above sea level.
Well, you're there, George, and you've been chasing this storm. You're from CBS4 in Miami, and you're up from South Florida chasing this storm. What's it like to observe the Mississippi River above you in the middle of a Category 3 hurricane?
Yeah, you know, it's quite a sight. There's levees around it, of course. Levees are basically mounds of dirt and other materials that are built up and supported by concrete to keep the river from overflowing. But just picture it. You're looking at a river with white caps flowing. It's not like the ocean. You don't have that wave, but you're starting to see waves in a river that normally doesn't have waves. We're not talking large waves. We're talking a foot, 2 feet at this point from my eye that I could see. So it's pretty interesting to think that the whole city is below sea level here.
And when you were saying that some parts of the city, you could tell the electricity had gone out, would that include in the French Quarter?
The French Quarter, parts of the French Quarter, which is where we're staying here in our live location, as well as staying over in one of the hotels here, there is no power. But then you go in a certain direction of the French Quarter, you know, Bourbon Street, the Party Street everyone's familiar with around the world. That's the French Quarter. And around it, it's very similar looking with the trestles and the balcony and all that. And some do have power, some do not have power. So it's interesting at this point to see it's not a full-range outage at this point.
And, of course, the French Quarter didn't flood barely at all post-Katrina in the aftermath after the levees failed then. So you're probably in a better place than others.
Yeah, we're in a better place. I mean, you know the word, St. Bernard Parish, the Ninth Ward, all those areas in the East Bank, they all flooded. Now the concern is the West Bank, the other side of the city that was barely untouched, or that was barely touched during Katrina. Now the fear is that side's going to get some sort of damage and flooding. But the French Quarter, you're right, not much flooding because, again, we're like 6-8 feet above sea level, which doesn't sound like a lot, but in a city that's below sea level, 8 feet above it, that's a party.
That's a good one. George Estevez, listen, we wish you best.
Thank you so much, Adora and John. Thank you.
Take care, George.
That's George Estevez. Right. He's a reporter for CBS4 Miami, and he's riding through Gustav as it makes its way through New Orleans.
Well, as Hurricane Gustav makes landfall at the southern end of the Mississippi River, Hurricane Sarah Palin is making landfall in St. Paul, Minnesota, where the Republicans are attempting to sort out how to run a convention when all this important news is taking place. The McCain campaign is expecting this week to roll out its new VP pick.
It's always safer in politics to just avoid risk and to go along with the status quo. But I didn't get into government to do the safe and easy things.
Sounding very enthusiastic and upbeat, that was Alaskan Governor Sarah Palin, announced on Friday as John McCain's pick for vice president. We go to the Republican convention now, live to Takeaway political director Andrea Bernstein. Sarah Palin, very upbeat, very enthusiastic, with a lot of credentials that, at least ostensibly, address issues that John McCain is concerned about in his whole campaign between now and November.
That's right. And Governor Palin has now arrived here in the Twin Cities. The place to be was the hotel where she was staying last night. She certainly has created a sort of frisson in the Republican Party. I mean, on the one hand, there is this excitement that in a year where the Republican brand, according to Republican strategists, is damaged, she is going to help with what they were worried about, which was suppression of the vote on the right. That she, because she is strongly pro-life has solid evangelical credentials, that will stimulate the vote at that wing of the party. On the other hand, a bit of an undercurrent of concern among some Republicans here that her relatively short term as governor makes it hard for them to argue that Barack Obama is inexperienced.
Well, I gather Barack Obama, they got a rise out of Barack Obama last night, who made some sort of comment.
That's right. I mean, you know, it's one of the things that's fascinating is that you may remember Barack Obama made his announcement about a vice presidential candidate on a 3 a.m. text message. And by 7 o'clock that morning, the McCain people had a television advertisement ready to go attacking Joe Biden. The only television ad that the Democrats have is a very soft one saying that, Governor Palin is John McCain's running mate. We know who his real partner is. And then they have a picture of John McCain and George Bush. Last night on 60 Minutes, Obama was asked about Governor Palin, and this is what he said.
She seems to have a compelling life story. Obviously, if she's a fine mother and a up-and-coming public servant. So it's too early for me to gauge what kind of running mate she'll be. My sense is that she subscribes to John McCain's agenda.
Well, she would certainly have to be on the ticket, but it felt to me as though Obama seemed a little uncomfortable talking about Sarah Palin at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's one of the things that the Democratic ticket is going to have to figure out, is how to handle Governor Palin. And, you know, the comment that he made, she's a fine mother, to some people that may sound like an important qualification. To others, it will sound dismissive. Up-and-coming public servant is how some people describe Barack Obama himself. So he may be treading on difficult territory when he gets into making an argument about who's more experienced, and already some Republicans are talking about that.
Well, we're going to talk about the strategy and the sort of strategic formula that Sarah Palin ostensibly represents here with this choice. But before we do that, Andrea, I mean, John McCain caught everyone in the media off guard on Friday. Do you think they've caught, and you've already sort of alluded to this a little bit, do you think they've caught the Democrats off guard?
It does seem that the Democrats have a certain lack of preparation, as evidenced by the fact that they haven't exactly come out swinging. They're probably figuring that out right now. I mean, on the campaign trail, Sarah Palin has helped John McCain draw some of his biggest crowds. He had about 17,000 people over in St. Louis. And by the way, if anybody is questioning whether the suspension of the convention activities is on message, you only have to look at the big graphic of John McCain and Sarah Palin at a rally in St. Louis, standing on a giant map of America that says country first. That is the opportunity that this suspension of the convention gives them the opportunity to argue. On the other hand, all of America is waiting with bated breath to hear more from Sarah Palin.
And they're going to learn about her.
My guess is the Republicans are very much hoping that she will have a chance to make a speech this week.
And they're going to learn about her meteoric rise from head of the PTA to mayor to governor of Alaska. It's an unusual trajectory, to say the least.
That's right, and she's very popular in Alaska. I mean, Alaskans that I've spoken to, talk fondly of the things that she's done. However, they do point out that on many issues, healthcare policy, education policy, foreign policy, she's still a cipher. And while she's been aggressive in certain areas, energy policy, and also taking on her own party on certain corruption issues, there are vast issues in the portfolio of a vice president and, of course, president that Sarah Palin has yet to address in her 2 years as governor of Alaska.
All right. Well, Andrea Bernstein, Takeaway political director, thanks for joining us from St. Paul. We're going to continue our discussion of the strategy of Sarah Palin and the rollout that's going to continue all week in St. Paul. Thank you, Andrea.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. It may have been downgraded to a Category 2 hurricane, but as our own Andrea Bernstein was reporting just a moment ago from St. Paul, Minnesota, Hurricane Gustav has disrupted day one of the Republican convention, at the very least interrupting the rollout of John McCain's vice presidential nominee, Sarah Palin, first-term governor from Alaska. Palin is a right-to-life advocate and a lifelong member of the NRA. McCain may hope she appeals to the Republican base that has been slow to embrace him. And in choosing the first Republican woman atop a presidential ticket, many believe the campaign hopes to attract women voters, maybe even some who formerly supported Senator Hillary Clinton. Is it a tall order? Well, to talk more about this is our Takeaway political director, Andrea Bernstein, back with us, and Tara Wall, who's deputy editorial page editor and columnist of The Washington Times. Tara, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, how do you sort of deconstruct the fairly elaborate strategy, at least potential strategy, that Sarah Palin represents here?
Well, I think she represents a number of things. I think, first of all, if you're looking at the game of chess, many might say, this, if not checkmate, this is check, and now it's Obama's move. I think this was a very stealth move on McCain's part that was probably unexpected by many, although she has been talked about for quite some time, more in a very general sense, not seriously up until, obviously, the announcement. But I think that it was probably the logical choice outside of the front runners, which were Mitt Romney and Mike Huckabee, primarily after when Obama picked Biden. Obama-Biden ticket for some represented a, you know, a return to Washington politics, whereas a McCain Palin ticket represents the outside of Washington new fresh approach to the campaign, and can be seen that way. I know I've certainly gotten my share of calls and emails from Republicans and conservatives responding to this pick.
Well, what does Sarah Palin have that Huckabee doesn't have, for instance, or Mitt Romney doesn't have?
Well, I think outside of the life issue, which, of course, Mike Huckabee has, and the social conservative issue, Mike Huckabee had problems with fiscal conservatives, particularly the way he ran Arkansas government. There were a lot of issues that some Republicans had in that regard. She, on the other hand, has been seen and is seen, even though she is a virtual novice in the area of holding office, as someone who has reformed government, who hit the ground running, making changes to government and transparency and ethics. I mean, she was on an ethics commission. She went after Republicans and then quit the ethics commission because of what she described as a lack of ethics.
Well, she definitely has a reputation in Alaska for going after the powerful politicians there.
Absolutely.
Let's listen to what the former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani had to say about the question of executive experience for the two-year term so far of Sarah Palin in Alaska.
Maybe it's my own background as a mayor and United States attorney, but this whole idea of executive experience to me would really qualify her. I mean, I think that she already has
more executive experience than Biden and
Obama combined.
You really do think that she is more qualified than Senator Obama would be? I mean, she's been the governor of a state with very small very small population, mayor of a town of 9,000 people?
Sure.
Bob Schieffer on Face the Nation asking a question of a former candidate and mayor of New York, Rudy Giuliani. Andrea Bernstein, were delegates or are delegates at the convention there in St. Paul buying this experience argument?
Well, I think the delegates are certainly saying that. I mean, I think there's some private worries. The state of Alaska is a fifth the size of Brooklyn, New York. So it's not an enormous place to have executive experience, although clearly she's run a government. The Democrats, for their part, argue that Barack Obama has run a Senate office and a very large and, they would argue, successful campaign well. So I think that what's happened here is that there's this whole discussion about experience, and everybody's trying to spin it their way. I think that we're going to see the Democrats treading lightly, though, on Sarah Palin. I mean, I think as we all saw when Hillary Clinton went in her first campaign for Senate, attacking a woman candidate can be toxic.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how Palin and Biden go up against each other in the debate, because Biden certainly has a reputation for pulling no punches ever.
He does. He does. And, there's a certain cleverness to the McCain campaign that they've done this. I mean, Sarah Palin both appeals to the right wing of the Republican Party. I also know that there are women out there who think that it's just kind of a neat thing to have a woman, politics aside. And, maybe it's a good idea to have a woman in the White House to bring it right to the boys.
Well, Andrea,
and the McCain campaign certainly hoping to appeal to that sentiment
right.
as well.
Andrea, I want to get a final comment from Tara Wall of the Washington Times. What do you make? I mean, her speaking ability seems pretty darn good compared to John McCain, if I may just speak personally. I mean, John has a very flat sort of speaking style. She's very animated, and I would think that would be an asset.
Yeah, I think people need to be careful not to count this woman out. I was among the skeptics early on when it was talked about because of the fact that she is just a first-term governor. Let's also remember Obama is a first-term senator. But when I started looking into her record and going into listening to her speeches, absolutely very sharp, very articulate, quick on her feet, not afraid to, obviously, as we said, tackle tough issues. I think when you talk about experience and what you'll hear the campaign talk about is that she has the ability that exceeds tenure in office. So it's a question of ability and what you've done with the time that you've had. And as many could see, there's not as much of a paper trail with Barack Obama. That's why it's hard to pin him down in these positions. Whereas with her, if you go back and look at the time that she has had, even as a mayor where she was making budget cuts and she gave herself a pay cut, I think almost in half, when you look at what she's done with the short time that she's had, I think that's how you make those contrasts. Now, she will have a tough job against Biden, and I wouldn't take that lightly either.
Well,
she's going to have a tough time with him.
Thank you, Tara. Tara Walls, deputy editorial page editor and columnist of the Washington Times, and Takeaway political director Andrea Bernstein is in St. Paul all week for us at the Republican National Convention. And now, headlines from Femi Oke.
Thank you very much, John. Just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. Hurricane Gustav is weakening a little bit. It's now a Category 2 storm, but it's still powerful, packing winds of 110 miles an hour as it moves forward. New Orleans is mostly empty, apart from reporters. Many locals heeded evacuation orders. We talked just a moment ago about the Republican VP nominee, Sarah Palin. She'll have a big role at the Republican convention kicking off in Minnesota. But today's events will be very low-key. Party officials scaled the schedule back because of Hurricane Gustav. Japanese Prime Minister Yasuo Fukuda is out. Unpopular at home, he stepped down today after less than a year in office. Japan has had a stretch of instability at the top. The previous prime minister barely served a year before quitting. Some 1.2 million people are homeless in the wake of severe flooding in northern India. Relief workers are working to help victims at risk of disease and in need of shelter and clean drinking water. And elsewhere in Asia, a different kind of natural disaster, a 5.7 magnitude earthquake, rocked China's Sichuan province again.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, which asks, is there an age when people should no longer be held accountable for their actions? Can someone be too old to be responsible? Or is that ageism? Opinions shared at responsibilityproject.com. Working, working, but it's still got so terribly far to go. I committed crime, Lord, I need.
Oh, good morning. It's The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. And even though it's Labor Day, we're working, though we're hoping that you're not. And we're asking you to help us make a playlist for this working day. Matthew in New Jersey emailed us and says his favorite song is this one, Work Song with Nina Simone. We'd like to hear from you, too. What's a good work song? 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. John?
We're going to have a whole bunch of work songs later on in this hour. But first, Hurricane Gustav has pushed under the radar a very significant milestone in Iraq today that Femi Oke has mentioned already. The U.S. has handed security control over Anbar province to Iraqi forces. province was once the center of the violence in the Sunni insurgency, but now it's one of the most peaceful areas in Iraq. Rob Watson is the BBC correspondent covering defense policy from London. Rob, thanks for joining us.
It's an absolute pleasure, and you're quite right. On any other day, this would be pretty much a lead story.
So what do we make of this milestone? I mean, aside from the fact that it's related to the surge strategy, I mean, in terms of the average Iraqi, this is pretty significant.
Well, I'd say two things. I think in terms of the average Iraqi, you know, they just sort of carry on with their lives and the kind of things that are bothering or not bothering them. I think in many ways it's more of a milestone for those of us outside of Iraq who look in on what's happening, because there's no doubt this is a milestone. I mean, it would have been quite unthinkable 2 years ago, the idea that US forces would be able to peacefully hand over to the Iraqi security services, because just two or so years ago, an internal US intelligence report was saying, we've lost it. We've lost Anbar to al-Qaeda.
Well, this is also a gigantic, it seems to me, vote of confidence for the Iraqi military. I mean, I would suspect that the Bush administration in the middle of an election year would not hand this over unless they were really sure that the Iraqis could handle it.
Well, I think a number of things. Again, I think that's certainly true. I think also it's just that the drop in violence itself has been so striking. I mean, at the absolute peak when things were at their worst in 2006, you were getting 26 attacks a day in Anbar province, and that is now down to about 4. Huge drop. I think it's certainly the case that the United States would probably have wanted to do this handover a little bit more slowly than the Iraqi government, because, you know, like any other good news story, there's a little bit of a kind of a cloud in here, and that is that the Iraqi government, it still kind of bothers them, the idea of these insurgents turned allies of the United States, the Sunni insurgents. They call themselves Awakening Councils. And I think the Iraqis wanted to take control of the place sort of sooner rather than later.
Well, I guess what you're saying tacitly is that behind the scenes, the U.S. is actually literally paying these organizations, these Awakening Councils. And I'm just wondering if that's more a matter of the effectiveness of the strategy than anything military.
Well, no, I think the biggest thing that happened in Anbar province is that al-Qaeda overplayed its hand. It started to impose a strict kind of Islamic rule that the local Sunni Muslims, they just didn't like a bit. I mean, they had a taste of what rule would be like under al-Qaeda. They didn't like it. The United States, to its credit, pretty much latched onto this very, very smartly, could see there was something to work with here. And yes, money has been involved. This operation has been hugely successful, but not cheap. The kind of 90-odd thousand or so Awakening Council members who are basically now fighting alongside the U.S. side, I mean, the wage bill is about $16 million a month.
Rob, what's the standard, though, here? You're saying that the attacks went from 26 a day to 4, obviously a major decrease, but how prepared are the Iraqi services?
Well, they're certainly much, much better than they were. I mean, the issue is more how are these local Sunni insurgents turned American allies, how are they going to fit in with the Iraq's national forces? Because I think that's now the outstanding issue. And you wouldn't be surprised to hear that in Iraq's Shiite-dominated government, there are some who think, hang on a minute, it wasn't that long ago these people were firing against us. They find it very difficult to forgive and forget. But the deal that's been reached, brokered by the Americans, is, look, you're going to have to incorporate these people into your security services, but it's sort of happening slower than the Americans and the Sunnis would like.
Very quickly, Rob, if we were going to look negatively now, because I'm, a member of the negative media, if we were going to look for this to unravel, where would it unravel?
Well, look, I mean, in broad terms, the way in which it could still unravel is that, that the various constituents that make up Iraq, the Shiites, Kurds, Sunnis, they still haven't really agreed on exactly what a national vision is for their country. But on the other hand, look, this is a positive day. And the good news is that although they haven't reached this unifying vision about where their country should go, people are talking, unimaginable 2 years ago.
Rob, certainly a headline they would have loved to have touted at the Republican National Convention in St. Paul today or for the rest of the week. Thank you, Rob Watson, BBC defense correspondent, joining us from London. Rob is great.
Oh, yeah, and you're right. I think it would definitely be a headline, as he mentioned, too. Clearly, for those who believe that the surge worked, this would be evidence in their mind of a successful policy.
Another story buried by Gustav. What else is being buried by Hurricane Gustav, Femi? Okay.
Hello there. Thanks for asking.
asking, John. It is just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Hurricane Gustav weakened just a little bit this hour. It now weighs in as a top strength Category 2 storm. That means the winds are peaking at around about 110 miles an hour. The fierce winds are now blasting coastal Louisiana and Mississippi as the storm pushes forward. In Mississippi, there are power outages. Its three coastal counties are bracing for flash flooding and tornadoes. Now, the evacuation of Louisiana is the biggest in its history. Almost 2 million people have moved out of the way of the hurricane. The practicalities to evacuation that we may not think about. For instance, Andy Overstaw had a restaurant freezer full of meat. So when Mike Polis walked by on Sunday, he got an unexpected present.
This gentleman owns this restaurant here, but he's throwing all his meat out, and so he just gave us, you know, hundreds of dollars worth of meat.
I have a lot of cleaning up to do. I have to empty every freezer and every cooler that I have, because when the power goes out, that just turns into a petri dish. It's disgusting.
Do you think we have time to get down there to get some more?
So I think it probably might have turned into a petri dish.
Might be too late, yeah.
But it might make a nice stew, do you think?
Could be. Well, yeah. It sounds like a great bonanza for some.
Mm-hmm. You could do all your shopping in 1 week. Just time it correctly. Although now we're heading down Tasteless Avenue, so I will move on. Gustav changed President Bush's travel plans a big time. Instead of speaking at the Republican convention in Minnesota, the president is going to Texas to watch the federal response to the hurricane. He plans to visit Louisiana later. Japanese Prime Minister Yasuo Fukuda says he will step down. He's had a tough year with low approval ratings. He served less than a year in the post. And a prominent human rights group says that Georgia admits to dropping cluster bombs on the breakaway province of South Ossetia. Human Rights Watch says it learned this through an official letter from Georgia's defense ministry. And finally, to perhaps the most peculiar story of the morning, South Korea says it's planning new measures to tackle its high suicide rate, one of the worst in the developed world. Officials say that they will build more screen doors on station platforms to stop people jumping under trains and will control the sales of common poisons.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning, I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
And I'm John Hockenberry, and of course it's Labor Day, a day off for millions of workers, a chance for shopping, barbecue, late summer parades and parties, but not much thought about work or workers. Labor Day is a bigger deal in communist China. Listen to the Chinese National Choir here. But in China and most of the world, Labor Day is actually on May 1st, not in September. And while this song, The Internationale, is the labor movement's theme song the world over, it's a little more obscure in the U.S.
Stand up, all victims of oppression, for the tyrants fear your might. Don't cling so hard to your position.
That's Billy Bragg, of course, popular artist, surely. But in America, tunes about work are generally more personal, anthems of drudgery.
Work all night and a drink of rum.
Daylight come and we won't go home.
Stack banana till the morning come.
Daylight come and we won't go.
Oh, Harry Belafonte. Or songs or ballads of how miserable it is to have to actually work for a living.
People say a man is made out of mud. Poor man's made out of muscle and blood and skin and bones. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16
Tennessee
tons.
Ernie Ford. The soulless world of the white-collar worker was the subject of the 1960s hit Broadway musical How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying.
Play it the company way. Wherever the company puts me, there I'll stay.
But what is your point of view?
I have no point of view.
Supposing the company thinks.
I think so, too.
Well, now, what would you say?
And that's a theme taken up by the women of the white-collar world in this famous Dolly Parton tune.
Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living, barely getting by. It's all taking and no giving, baby.
Fedora is dancing on the table right now.
Occasionally, in my chair. I'm dancing in my chair.
Occasionally, pop songs about work have been broad critiques of the post-industrial age. Here, John Lennon rails against the conformist culture of office life in Working Class Hero.
There's room at the top, they are telling you still. But first you must learn how to smile as you kill.
But in... And a half century earlier, Paul Robeson sang this bitter tune about union organizer Joe Hill.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me.
But in general, there's a kind of pop resignation to the work world. Don't rock the boat, and when in doubt, just sing along.
Work and work.
Well, those cars never seem to stop coming.
Work and work.
Keep those bags and machines humming.
Work.
I actually worked at a car wash once a long time ago. And occasionally, though, in the work world, when things get really bad, there's always this.
Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more.
Or in the genteel 21st century, we call that a career change. Tell us your favorite work song or anti-work song. You can leave a message on our Spinbox line at 877-8MY-TAKE or leave a comment at thetakeaway.org. Happy Labor Day, folks.
This job and shove it. I ain't working here no more.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. On this Monday, September 1st, we have the very latest headlines for you from Femi Okeh. Hey there, Fem.
Hello there to you, Adora. It is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Hurricane Gustav has weakened to a Category 2 storm, but that doesn't mean the low-lying Louisiana Bayou area just west of New Orleans that's right in the storm of the path isn't going to be completely flooded. The town of Houma is in the direct line, and the only protection that Houma has are drainage levees about 10 feet tall, about the same height of the expected storm surge. Now, the really, really good reporters are the ones who happen to be meteorologists and know where to find the center of the storm. Here's Jim Cantori. He's in Houma.
Now, what we've had so far, guys, we've had numerous trees and power lines knocked down already. Power is out throughout the city. We lost it about an hour and 20 minutes ago here in Houma.
That's Jim Cantori just reporting on the storm where he's standing right in the path of it. It will be expected to move inland completely in the next couple of hours. Also, at this week's Republican National Convention in St. Paul, Minnesota, officials decided to scale back today's festivities on account of Hurricane Gustav. The convention's opening day program will be shortened to about 3 hours, and President Bush and Vice President Cheney won't address delegates. But First Lady Laura Bush and Cindy McCain will speak about helping storm victims. That's a quick look at your main headlines for this morning.
Thanks, Femi. John, what if you went home and all four of your kids were no longer there?
You know, actually, today I will be going home. They're with their grandmother. So actually, I am going home to an empty house, just Allison and me.
And that's not so fun, is it?
It isn't. Actually, we were talking about it last night. We were weeping about it last night.
Well, it's really a tough time for thousands of parents across the country, and they're dropping their kids off at college campuses. Obviously, the easy part is getting there, but the hard part is going to be leaving them behind. Right, Sandra Mark Reardon? You're a mother of three. Your house must be very quiet right now.
It's very quiet.
And you just sent your son to University of Massachusetts at Amherst, so congratulations on that. And he's the last of your children to head off to college. How do you feel about now?
Well, I feel like an empty nest, that's for sure. You know, minus the family pets that were left behind.
So you still have the pets?
We still have the pets, yes.
Also joining us is family psychiatrist Dr. Alan Manovitz from the New York Presbyterian Weill Cornell Medical Center. Good morning, doctor.
Good morning.
So Sandra's feeling like so many parents, about now. How do you describe it? What have you learned from your patients?
Well, an empty nest is a phrase that encapsulates feelings of sadness and loss that a parent or guardian experiences when children no longer live with them or need day-to-day care. But it's important to kind of note that it's a normal reaction for a cycle of life for a parent to feel this sadness, and that it's not life or death, but it's really a normal transition, not abandonment. It's a time of reflection of a really, hopefully, a job well done, and that the kids are now at a time we want them to separate and individuate.
Mm-hmm.
But the emptiness syndrome is a psychological condition that sometimes surprises people, where they have this intense sadness or loneliness that's traditionally or stereotypically been given to a woman around the time the last of her children leave home.
Let's bring in Sandra for a second. Sandra, this is the third child that you've had leave home. So how was it different this time than when the other two took off?
Well, because when the other two left, there were still other children left at home, so that my role as, you know, day-to-day mother was still intact.
But you know, these days, you know, kids just live with their parents after college, so, you know, maybe you're going to get a break here.
No, actually, the two that left initially have come back for a month or two in between jobs or relocation.
There you go.
Exactly, yeah.
That they call the fullness syndrome.
But doctor, what do you recommend to parents who are going through this difficult transition? I mean, for 18 years, they've had these children at home day in and day out, and now they're off building their own lives.
Yeah, absolutely. In reality, I also want to just mention it affects men and fathers equally, and it can occur not just when the last child leaves home, but when any child leaves home or at earlier stages of development. And that's really a warning sign. So if you're somebody who really kind of mourns the loss of your infancy and toddlerhood, or you really have trouble with the first day of school, or when the kid goes away to sleepaway camp, you have mothers have the equivalence to the child's homesickness, or in high school when the kids begin to become more independent and make more decisions for themselves, those are really warning signs that somebody may feel overly sad at each stage of the child's growth, or if they're particularly like a helicopter mom, have high separation anxiety, because being a full-time mom, which is a wonderful, wonderful experience, is a double-edged sword. For men, traditionally, they have their work and family, and for women, work is family. So when the family is, quote, gone, they have the danger of feeling bereft.
So what do you recommend? What have you found helps people in the midst of this transition?
Well, I think that if you plan in advance and develop other interests than those only associated with your children, that is, if your whole life is involved with the PTA or a variety of activities that parallel the child, you're not really developing yourself as a person. In modern days, there was initially an increase in the empty, quote, nest syndrome, because kids really move on and kind of move away from the kind of area where the family lives. But today we have children being born later, and parents are developing interest before having the children and continuing them throughout the childhood years. And also with modern communication devices, things like having a video phone or talking through the computer where you can actually see your child really goes a long way towards modifying this.
And Sandra, you could just get a little apartment there in Amherst. It's a 90-minute drive from East Falmouth, right?
No, it's actually a 2.5-3 hour drive, but I'm not interested.
What are you thinking about doing with some of this now extra time that you have?
Well, pursuing, you know, more fully the hobbies that I had that, you know, were time limited and because of, you know, child care issues and that type of thing. But I also have a career that I've had throughout raising my children that, you know, will continue.
So what kind of hobbies? Let us in on that secret there.
Well, I'm looking forward. I've wanted to take golf. You know, my husband's always been a golfer, so now perhaps I can participate. And I'm looking forward to horseback riding again and, you know, several things.
And just explain, because your husband's work really takes him away for long periods of time.
He does. Yes, it does. It does. So that, you know, we're in the midst of, you know, contemplating somewhat of a job change for him so that he's not gone as many months as he has been all these.
Yeah, describe his job and then how long he goes away for.
He's a commercial fishing captain up in Alaska, based out of Dutch Harbor, and, you know, he's gone 6 to 8 months a year. And he's having difficulty knowing that, you know, he's been away since after Michael graduated high school, and when he arrives home the end of September, beginning of October, his son is no longer at home.
So, Doctor, tough times for parents. We're going to let you get in another word of advice here.
Well, you know, I think that it's also to be aware that this is also a period of time that other stages of life, that other major changes are going on. Some women are going through menopause, coping with increasingly dependent elderly parents, and sort of readjusting, as your guest on there, the equilibrium at home, you know, with your spouse. So it's important to also work with your spouse, not just to have your children in common, but to have your own, you know, activities between the two of you. And really, this can, for a small percentage of people, if you find yourself crying excessively or feeling so sad you don't want to mix with friends or go to work, or your appetite, concentration, or energy or sleep is disturbed, you really need to get some counseling from a family friend or a pastor or a doctor to get your feelings into perspective. And you may need to treat an underlying depression or anxiety disorder if it gets quite severe.
Dr. Alan Manovitz, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Manovitz is from New York Presbyterian Weill Cornell Medical Center. He's a family psychiatrist. And Sandra Mark Reardon, thanks so much for joining us. She's the mother of three who just dropped her son Michael off at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst.
Coping with empty nest back to school day. But today is Labor Day. We hope you got the day off. At The Takeaway, we're working, of course, and we're putting together our own Labor Day playlist. What song do you think is best for Labor Day?
This is Mary from Manhattan. My favorite work song is Bang on the Drums, Todd Rundgren.
That's a great one to end our show here. But anyhow, here's your takeaway.
On any other day, this would be pretty much a lead story.
That was the BBC defense correspondent Rob Watson talking about the U.S. handing over Iraq's Anbar province to Iraqi forces.
The heads are still bobbing in the control room of the work zones. We, of course, are following the latest on Hurricane Gustav. Its status has been downgraded to Category 2, still capable of producing winds topping more than 100 miles an hour. It will reach land in a few hours. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway, and we wish you a lovely Labor Day.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.